You are listening to Indie Bay Radio here in San Francisco, California. This is Friday, the 29th of April, and yesterday there was a fine victory in the world of civil rights. The infamous pepper spray case went to jury, and in a matter of 12 hours, the jurors found unanimously that the police and sheriff's department in Humboldt County, California, were entirely in the wrong for applying Q-tips with pepper spray into the eyes directly of people protesting the logging of redwoods and essentially the failure to prosecute the infamous savings and loans crook Charles Hurwitz. So on the phone with us is one of the lead attorneys, J. Tony Serra. And hello, Tony.
Good afternoon. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, great. And just to run down, you have been a great attorney in the, well, for the last, what, 30-something years. You go all the way back into the 60s with Black Panthers cases, American Indian Movement, any number of great successes. Here's another one to put on your notch to put on your civil rights gun. Tell us about what happened yesterday.
Well, in a surprise to everyone, because this case has been tried twice previously and it's hung, first time 4-4, last time we had 6 out of 8, but the jurors were out for the longest time. Obviously, when you hang, they're out, you know, until they finally declare mistrial. So it was drawing close to 5 o'clock, you know, it's only the second day, and we expected that there's conflict. Unfortunately, there shouldn't be, but in this day and age, there's a lot of jurors that are, you know, completely pro-law enforcement. So we expected it to be a long time, and we were just about ready to leave at 5. The jury was going to go home at 5, and we hear the message they've reached a verdict. So, boy, we wondered. I mean, it's too fast, and, well, that's good. When there's a fast verdict, it's usually on the, well, in the criminal, it'd be bad. It's usually on the prosecutor's side, but in the civil world, it's usually on the plaintiff's side. So, there was a lot of hushed anxiety in the court and a lot of heavy breathing, let's just say, at counsel table. And they walked in, and you know, when you're a plaintiff, you're closest to the jury. You have that prerogative, allegedly, because you have the burden. So the prosecution, you know, is always has eye contact, and normally in a criminal case, defense attorneys are far away. So I'm up close this time. I'm looking at the jury, and I'm trying to get that eye contact. Where there's eye contact, and these are imprecise, you know, psychological kind of probes, but it kind of means they're for you, and if we get good eye contact in a criminal case, it means there's an acquittal. And these jurors, man, none of them looked at us. They were looking away. They were looking stern. There was no motion on their face. Normally when it's, you know, pro a party, their smiles toward in that direction or some demeanor manifestation. So, shit, we thought we lost. Like, oh, God, you know, and how could it go the other way? I can't believe it. I can't accept it. And then the verdict, from my perspective, was a mixed metaphor. The verdict in essence said that, and this is good, and this is strong, and this should resonate throughout the country, that the application of pepper spray by Q-tip in these instances, and this is a lockdown in Black Bear by nonviolent young people, so that in those kind of circumstances, it was unreasonable and was excessive force. You know, so hallelujah. In part, you know, we soared. You know, were exhilarated. At least I was, and I think I manifest the mood of everyone at our table. But then, toward the end, when it talked about damages, like a dollar, as they name off the plaintiffs, a dollar, and you know, at that point for me, and I seldom submit to a motion, lawyer can't really manage, you can do control the motion, you know, as a gesture, as a kind of like vocabulary gesture, but you cannot really emote. But I got pissed, man. I said, like these kids, you know, 16 and 17-year-old young women, and they were in agonizing pain, and they all manifest the post-traumatic, you know, stress symptomology, all of them. They'll never be the same. To give them $1 is an insult, and I was just, you know, fuming. And then, of course, you settle down, and I get back into the pragmatic lawyer mold, and so what was important always was never the money, and when we sought to resolve this case, we said, if you promise never to use pepper spray, we ain't going to ask for a goddamn cent, and they wouldn't promise, and although they haven't used it in that fashion since. But so it was the principle, and this will deter law enforcement throughout the country from ever doing eye swab, you know, pepper spray application. Even though we didn't get any money, it's mainly because these people are not Western medicine oriented. You know, did you go to a doctor? No. Did you go to a psychiatrist? No. Why don't you go? I don't believe in Western medicine. Well, what do you believe in? Well, I went to a masseuse, you know. Well, what happened? They massaged my eyes and it made me feel better, but I still have a hard time getting to sleep. So, you know, we never had evidence here that courts take cognizance of that amounted to medical costs or loss of wages, and in that sense I accept it. And I know they compromised. We would have had probably no verdict at all if they, you know, gave substantial amounts. It is a victory. It will deter law enforcement. It was torture, and this validates our perspective that it was torture, you know, on young nonviolent people. So still, you know, my mind jubilates and my psyche aches because they got, no money out of it. And I know that the defense attorneys, you know, for them, it's the milking, you know, of the money cow, because they've already admitted they've made $750,000 on the case, and they're going to, before these plaintiffs even receive their dollar bill, it's going to go up to the Ninth Circuit. They'll petition for certiorari before the Supreme Court. It'll be goddamn 10 years before they get their dollar plus interest. So, you know, it once more will get into theater of the absurd, but we have closure. The activists are happy. We've set, you know, a de facto precedent. The Ninth Circuit opinion was a wonderful precedent, and therefore, in the totality, we won, and, you know, we're proud and we're happy.
Well, that said, and this comes into a number of different things. I was able to attend the first one, the Vaughn Walker case.
Yeah.
And there were a number of Vaughn Walker was not interested in discussing the reason for the protest. He didn't want to get into in this case. Well, he did not allow the there was an infamous example of the way pepper spray was brought onto the market was through an FBI agent who essentially accepted bribes from the pepper spray industry, and he eventually did a certain amount of time in prison for accepting bribes. And that latter thing.
Ilston didn't allow in, but Ilston was generous with what she called context.
So the reason.
Trials, there's context, there's subtext, there's pretext. But she said under the necessity to make cogent, to make understandable, to make explainable all of the behavior on both sides, that the context was admissible. And, of course, defendants didn't want the context. And what does that mean? And it means just the things that you've said, that, you know, the ultimately the ancient redwoods were being harvested to pay for a junk bond. And, you know, it was a capitalist ripoff, and local people, including the loggers, or at least a number of loggers, were dead against it. It would have reduced, and has in many respects, the redwood forests to stumps, to ultimate desert, destroying the ecology, destroying, you know, all of the bird life. life and animal and insect life, a complete disaster, you know, a blister, you know, on the hand and face of the planet. So we did get all of that in. We got it into the plaintiffs, and, you know, they're fantastically beautiful people. They're young idealists. None of them, you know, have anything to do with, I don't know what you want to call it, contributing negatively to things like war effort. And I mean, they're organic farmers, and one was a Buddhist nun, and you know, another is poet and a masseuse, and it goes on like that. They were like people who were giving the best of their youth in an idealistic way to help heal the planet and to serve humankind. And through them, we got in their visions of the, you know, the majesty of the redwoods and their experiences at the base camp where they were trained in nonviolent demonstration and nonviolent protests, and everything they did was dedicated to nonviolence. And all of that came out, and it, in a way, it's like an unseen flood in the court, you know, where you're submerged in their altruism and their sacrifice and their bravery. Some of these young people, see, the eye swab had never occurred before with regard to nonviolent persons. The pepper spray had never occurred again. So when they said, we're going to use chemical agents on you, and they closed their eyes, and pretty soon the cops are opening your eyes and they're swabbing it, they thought they were going to be blinded. They were so brave, they were willing to be blinded to get their point across at that moment. They didn't know. It had never been done before. There was not, you know, research on it. And therefore, you know, it was a mystery of a potential, you know, disaster. So that really came across, and, you know, we got in the underlying causes. A lot of the videos depict the demonstrations, and their placards, you know, got to the underlying causes. And it made the case intrinsically, and from my perspective, per se, political. It was a political case, and the court was packed, and, you know, the jurors felt that, and the jurors were in a high state of anxiety over that. They were in exhausted state after, you know, approximately being court 3 weeks, which isn't that long, and it was because that the political, you know, image of the case was manifest in the plaintiffs and manifest in the crowds that attended court. And obviously a lot of these people were pro-law enforcement, and I think that you know, they felt a huge conflict in their emotions and their mentality and their ideology. And, you know, it was a good thing. We finally brought over the opponents, you know, of our position. And part of the way you win them, and it's through heart and mind, is the attendance, you know, of the supporters. I think that's so important in a political case, and they were so, you know, supportive in this case.
Well, that's great. You mentioned a little side comment about the jurors, and that they tended to side with the police. If I understand right, here in the San Francisco Bay Area, when they have a jury pool, they tend not to bring them from San Francisco, but
we had the only one from the city.
Yeah, they tend to stack the deck, right, from out in southern Alameda and
places like Concord, or, you know,
right, Contra Costa, right,
Redwood City, Marin County.
So were they made up of? The jury was made up?
Federal juries, I'll give you two generalizations. One is they are more superannuated than the norm. Secondly, they are more conservative than the norm. Third, they are more wealthy than the norm. So federal juries, as a general rule, you know, tend to be pro-law enforcement, and I'm talking really after 9/11. Do you understand that's 9/11? everything in the courts changed, where you were attacking police brutality or police misconduct, overreaching governmental, you know, transgression. All of those kind of things were very difficult to convince a jury because, you know, we've been brainwashed. The Reagan administration brainwashed. We see, you know, potential, I don't know, chaos and disaster at every intersection. We're all afraid that we're going to be bombed, that terrorists abound, you know, in our environment, that we're insecure. And so remember the thin blue line, the thin blue line that puts the officers that protect us from this. They're putting their life on the line. They are, you know, our protectors, our saviors. And so that all kind of flushing back all that kind of old-fashioned thought about the police and people saying, I'll give up my Fourth Amendment. I've got nothing to hide, you know, and First Amendment isn't worth much nowadays. So it's very, very conservative. The thin blue line now is the what I'll call, you know, the broad blue barrier between the Constitution, ultimately, and the populace, and you know, the Constitution shrinking as a consequence of the police intrusions into a number of fields that they, including torture, which they never, you know, had a hand in. We outsource torture. We do that. We got a terrorist, oh, send them to Egypt. So, you know, my country, right or wrong, police officers, right or wrong, it's kind of like a psychological dimension of belief that adheres to the general populace. So it makes this kind of case really hard. You know, even though if it, you know, looks like torture, if it talks like torture, if it smells like torture, it's probably torture. I mean, they saw the video. You shouldn't have to go any farther than that. Your mind, your emotions, you know, know that that is unnecessary, that that's brutal, that, you know, is only an image of a totalitarian state, that is torture, and that pain compliance is just, you know, another euphemism for torture. You know all of that, and yet these people, you know, that are frightened deeply and adhere to, you know, police and military as their, you know, insulation from disaster, they are unwilling to really attribute what they see to their value system. What? So that's why this case hung. I can't, you know, when I first looked at the videos, holy shit, how could this case hang? It's torture per se. It's completely unnecessary. And we had our expert, you know, 76-year-old police captain out of New York, and he knew everything, and he was like full of charisma and strength and morality, and he says, you know, like, and then he says more experience in law enforcement than anyone in the court, any of these defendants, and he said, you never use force on nonviolent protesters, period. You wait them out, you negotiate them out, you know, you carry them out, you don't use force. And he's absolutely right. And this is a guy, you know, who's probably completely pro-law enforcement. 30 years or more, he was in law enforcement in New York where there's a lot of heavy things have gone down. And, you know, that's his view, and it's the right view, and it's the only view that any enlightened culture should have. You know, in all of these instances, they go, oh, you want to sit here? Sit here. You need to, we will send you in food or water. And then you put a sign out, listen, this office is closed today. We're conducting business down the street or some shit like that. They don't have to fucking torture people. Yeah. So, what am I saying? It should have been slam dunk first trial. It took three trials. It took a number of years. It took like the Supreme Court and the Ninth Circuit to bring it to fruition. And hallelujah, it's over. And let's hope that they never use this kind of torture again, you know, in like circumstances.
Well, that said, would you, if they had not had videotapes of this, do you think the case would have been even as easy as this? For example,
we would have no chance. But mind you, again, it's a mixed metaphor. They, law enforcement, took the goddamn videos.
Well, that's right.
They, the ones see who actually do the application or the infliction, you know, of the Q-tip pepper spray, we don't sue them. They weren't in this lawsuit. It's the policymakers. You know, it's the Gestapo up there in the office that tells them to do it. These officers maybe didn't even want to do it. So that's why they took video, because they were told to do it, and I guess they figured what they were doing, since they were told by their superiors, was legal. So we were very lucky to have the video. We would not have even probably brought the case without the video, because percipient witnesses were either police or, you know, the loggers for Pacific Lumber, their security officers, their honchos, and they would have said things like this, because I've read a report. Oh, the police officer, very respectful. See, some of these loggers, they gave statements, and they didn't know that it was video, and the video came out later. So they're saying things like this. Oh, we watched it. The officers were respectful. Oh, the officers didn't hurt any of them. They were screaming, but that was a fabricated scream. They said, 1, 2, 3, scream. And, oh, they were perverse. These demonstrators used the F word over and over again. And when they came in, it sounded like a bomb exploding when they dropped the stump. All this kind of exaggerating, you know, police support bullshit, because the video contradicts everything they said. Nobody said the F word. They came in chanting and singing. You know, no one tried to scare anyone. The stump didn't make much of a sound at all. The officers were brutal. You know, all of the percipient witnesses were exaggerating and falsifying. We wouldn't have had a case at all, thank God for the video.
You know, and that said, one would never expect that Dan Lundgren, the former Attorney General under Pete Wilson, would be a witness to your side, but he actually had a letter that said that this was torture, and that letter was not allowed as evidence.
Right.
And then,
hey, I'm a criminal lawyer, so the vagaries of, like, civil evidence rules escaped me, and they were allowed to put in the fact that in 1998 Post, you know, said that a direct application of chemical agent was appropriate in some circumstances. I mean, it didn't completely befit the situation, but it was after the fact, so it was meaningless, and, you know, from our perspective, it was done so that it kind of supported or fortified the defense with some kind of a, you know, policy decision that would okay what they did. So it was really shoring up the leak, let's say, so the dam wouldn't burst. And the judge let that in. And Gilson's a good judge.
Oh, I know. And there was also...
We couldn't get in that the Attorney General said no, that it's bad.
Right. And as such, I was able to attend the day that, was it Kirkpatrick, the fellow that actually applied the Kirkpatrick. And he was asked by the defense attorney a series of questions about, are you an expert in this? And he became an expert, 5 years later or something like that, through Post. But his expertise, he was completely new to it. And but they tried to shade the evidence of his expert status as after the fact. And you just mentioned it as well, that Post, Peace Officers Standards and Training, essentially declared that it was okay to do, but also after the fact. And as you mentioned also, the video evidence, he claimed that he had applied it from 1 foot, although he claimed later in his testimony that the label on the bottle says don't do it from further or from closer than 3 feet.
Yeah.
And then the video itself shows that he's got her head shoved into his crotch, and he's got it maybe 1 inch away. You can just see it bubbling around.
They applied over the closed eyelids, you know, right at the point of contact, the slit or whatever you want to call it. And then for some, they opened the eyeball. And the way they were allegedly trained to do it, but I think this is bullshit too, is to put a little bit on each side of the eye. Not on the eyelid, not on the eyelid closure, not on the eyeball, but a little bit on each side.
Right.
And it would kind of leak into the corners of your eye. So that, you know, is allegedly how they train. Now that, in my mind, is excessive force. You know, regardless.
And
but that's not what happened. That's not what we saw in the video. We didn't see a little dab on the left. taken a little dab on the right. We saw it applied in the most forceful and brutal manner.
And luckily enough,
you know, when the policymakers put into effect, in essence, a fury, you know, a horrific methodology, they are responsible. Whether or not they said, oh, just dab it on the side of the eye, they let loose here, you know, a terrible, you know, method. I call it, you know, they let loose a fury. It was, from my perspective, torture per se. Is an image that can never be allowed, you know, in any free society. So, you know, I guess we're past it now. But understand that part of the reason pepper spray is that, like, they're not really fighting to use it, is they got the taser now. We're in taser territory.
Oh, yeah.
In pepper spray territory, there had been outlined and available, you know, to the sheriff, but he didn't avail himself of it, and that there had been 100 deaths associated, that's a euphemism in quotes, associated with pepper spray, and only 2 deaths wherein they had concluded, and I presume by autopsy of pathologists, that pepper spray was a contributing factor. But, you know, none, there had been never, these people are normally ground out of these black bears, there had been never a mishap, a scratch once, you know, by someone who wasn't cooperating. But they were kept saying, oh, it's going to start a fire. Well, it never had started a fire in 10 years, nor in shops, you know, that used them. And secondly, oh, it's going to disintegrate, oh, it'll burst, it'll hit the officer, it'll hit the person, this here is dangerous. Well, it never disintegrated. It never has. It's built not to. So their rationale that pepper spray, you know, was more harmless or whatever is, one, betrayed by the evidence, and two, it's just a patent lie. So, you know, pepper spray is a horrible thing. And here's how these death certificates read. I didn't die of pepper spray. It was an excited delirium. Oh, an excited delirium. What the hell was that? Oh, that's like, you know, metabolic rush. What is that? Well, that's kind of hyper, you know, kinetic. Well, it sounds to me that, because they all admit that pepper spray, you know, does put you in this kind of panic attack frame of mind. It's pepper spray. So the fact that they called it by some other name, some euphemism, excited delirium, doesn't mean that it ain't pepper spray. And then they call it associated with instead of caused it. That doesn't mean that it wasn't, you know, one of the causative factors. So the whole field is, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, a governmental kind of a whitewash, what would you call it, Orwellian double talk. You know, we're doing it for you. We're trying to help you. It's your, you know, harm to you that we're concerned with. That's why we're here fucking blinding you in the eye. So, you know, it was an expose on what I'll call, you know, police Orwellian, you know, double talks. And that was like a fascinating part of it for me.
Would you say that the idea of cruel and usual punishment is being ramped up in this?
Cruel and unusual punishment normally talks about what's done by sentence, you know, by a judge, the nature of the sentence. So, you remember the electric chair, or whatever, the shooting the prisoners, the death penalty defendants in Utah, they used to shoot them up against a wall with a thing around their eyes. So, no, it's not normally, this is a pre-conviction penalty. Oh, this is a punishment. They wanted to break the movement. They had 10,000 people up there demonstrating. frustrating. People were coming in from all over the country. This was going to be Redwood Summer. They were going to stop the harvest of redwoods. These little police forces and the county budget, they couldn't, you know, whatever you want to call it, control them, couldn't, take charge. They had to do something. So what they did is they intentionally inflicted pain. They intentionally tortured because they thought that would deter others. And then when they came in, for instance, the Riggs, after you know, Scopey, they asked one of the, they asked Bonka, you know, one of the plaintiffs, one of the demonstrators, because she signed up for another one. So this was her second one where she got, I swabbed. And they said, haven't you told everyone about it? You know, like, wasn't it so terrible? Their intent was to defuse and deter the movement. That was their ulterior motive. That's why it was intentional infliction of mental anguish. They wanted everyone to say, oh, it's so horrible, don't go do that. You better not get near a black bear. They're going to put it in your eye, man. It's going to blind you. I still have nightmares. I'm deep in depression over it. I can't sleep anymore. They wanted that to everyone to be told, those kind of things, so that the demonstrators and the movement would be broken. That's what I argued to the jury. You know, it's unthinkable, but they couldn't handle thousands and thousands and thousands of young people coming, chanting, and parading into their county. So it was like a desperate measure. And, you know, obviously we didn't prove that, but it's certainly a permissible inference, and from my perspective, it's, you know, a probable motivation.
Right. And there are so many just different layers of this whole thing that I saw. You're cruel and unusual. That is actually after due process of sentencing. But in this case, this was before sentencing.
Right.
These are innocent until...
We all know that police officers take, you know, a pound of flesh in their mind, you know, as direct retribution, as old fashioned eye for eye and tooth for tooth. They take it on the scene, and it's a pre conviction penalty, and it can be with brutality, it can be with an inordinate bail, it can be by, you know, psychological forms of interrogation, it can be threatening to arrest your wife or take your kids away. They all do that. That's part of their mythology. They want to break it down. The old-fashioned cop would take a fucking, you know, few kicks at you, you know, literal kicks, and be very physical, and they're still very physical. So law enforcement has not adopted in any manner a presumption of innocence. It's a presumption of guilt, and for them the court system is, you know, like unnecessary, and what they really want to do is they want to extract the penalty at the time of arrest. And I'm generalizing, but, you know, it's enough true that it is certainly a danger to the whole system.
Well, that's right. And as we wrap up, I wanted to ask you, what sort of a precedent can this send in most federal courts?
Fabulous. This is why. But again, I said they've moved on to taser, so maybe it doesn't count as much. The appellate decision in a nutshell says that this form of application, you know, is unreasonable, but, and the plaintiffs have a right, you know, to a jury trial on it because, recall, Von Walker dismissed the case. So we have an appellate court decision saying that if we can prove, which we prove, that it's unreasonable. Then secondarily now we have a jury saying that it was unreasonable, and unreasonable means excessive force. Unnecessary, excessive, and unreasonable force to effectuate arrest on a nonviolent, peaceful protester. So even though we didn't get any damages because we didn't have medical evidence, counties and cities all over the country, they become conversant with the Ninth Circuit opinion. They become conversant with the result here. It has to go into their training manual, into their policy statements. And what do they fear? They fear, since liability is more or less established by the case and especially by the appeal, that next time, should they venture, you know, into this area, the persons will go to a doctor and will have medical testimony. and the people will go to a psychiatrist, and we will have psychiatric, you know, residuals, and therefore they cannot risk it. They will not do it. They, you know, won't expose themselves to that financial catastrophe, and therefore that's the meaning of this case. The meaning of the case is that in their little arsenal, you know, of I don't know, direct contact with arrestees, the pepper spray by direct application is a taboo. It won't occur any longer, and that's a victory of sorts. But understand, they've migrated now to taser, and whether our case extends by analogy or not, I don't know. But I imagine it does if a taser was used at very close range, something like that, or if a taser was shot into very sensitive areas, you know, of your body, I think the case would extend by analogy into those areas, and therefore it's a good thing.
You know, it's funny you mentioned tasers. I've got a CD-ROM that comes from the Taser company, and they are showing off about the new version of it. And this really deals with the upgrading of technology. So apparently the older tasers expected that the cloth would diffuse the electric charge. So I think it's 50,000 watts, or is it volts? I think it's volts. 50,000 volts, and that 90% of it would be diffused in the clothing. The new one, 90% of it goes straight ahead past the clothing. So even though they're using the same 50,000, 10% is being diffused by the clothing, and then, you know, 40,000 is going into your body.
For further analogies, you see, pepper spray, either sprayed or applied to aged people with heart attack propensity, you know, bad heart, people with bronchial infliction, asthmatic people, can be fatal. And they're never warned, so nobody warns, hey, if you're asthmatic, this could be fatal, you better unlock. So no warning. Likewise, taser. If you have a weak heart, or you have whatever, high blood pressure, you have hypertension, you're hit with a taser, that's going to kill you. You see, you're vulnerable. You're weakened to a condition. They don't say, you know, before a taser, listen, if you have these medical conditions, I have to warn you, you ought to submit because it could kill you. Even if they said it, that wouldn't, you know, be adequate, but still, they don't say it. So, the, you know, there's always going to be a percent of the population that's highly vulnerable to any kind of a chemical or electrical weapon, and if this case curtails that expansion, you know, that evolution of weaponry that police have, and then it will have made a great, how would I call it, you know, nick in their armor, and it's a good thing. But, you know, let's not be naive. The world will never be the same. And I'm talking about the law enforcement world versus citizenry after 9/11. It's going to get worse, man. You know, we got search warrants now without probable cause. We got sneaking peeks without probable cause. We can, to a certain extent, you know, outsource our torture in certain areas. Already, the Fourth Amendment really doesn't exist. The Fifth Amendment really doesn't exist. We're on our way in a very bad direction, and Bush has capitalized off the fear of the people. And in terms of what you lose, when you lose a constitutional right, you never get it back. You know, if it's eroded, if it is diminished, you never get it back.
Well, I've always contended that if they were able to use these same sneak and peek Homeland Security tricks on the Enron people, they would shut down those laws right away. It's funny you mentioned that many of the activists were actively working against Charles Hurwitz. Humboldt County was essentially being looted by Charles Hurwitz, the famous savings and loans crook.
It's the illness, you know, I don't know, the cancer of capitalism. This whole junk bond manner of purchase, you know, the whole notion of like corporations that can amass such wealth, and they exist, you know, internationally. So it's like some kind of a me amoeba that if it's threatened at one level, it kind of reassembles itself in another location. You know, what is the enemy? The true enemy is the corporation and the capitalism that corporations spawn and exploit by. So there's Hurwitzes out there at every dimension is what I think.
Oh, absolutely, there are.
That's another story.
Yeah, that's right. Hey, we sure thank you, Tony, for doing the interview.
Pleasure, and thanks for asking.
Yeah, no trouble.
Catch you later.
All right, thanks again. So that was Tony Serra, one of the lead attorneys for the infamous pepper spray case. He's been around for many, many years. A lot of Black Panthers cases, American Indian Movement cases, many, many civil rights cases of all different types. Great to have him on our side. And one more notch in his karmic belt.